Welcome to Design Oracles. We are here to pontificate, evangelize, and educate you on residential interior design and architecture.
I'm Amity Worrell, interior designer of Amity Worrell & Company.
And I'm Diane Kett, architect of DK Studio.
Welcome, everybody.
Hello. I'm Diane.
And I'm Amity, and we are Design Oracles. And we're coming to you today with another expert to educate and inform us. Mike, can you introduce yourself today?
Yeah, thank you. My name's Mike Reed. My company is Austonian Rug Cleaning, and we've been around since 1984 and helping people with their rugs, either cleaning or repairing, that sort of thing.
You have quite a bit of expertise in the rug repair area, which I find really, really fascinating. Can you talk to us a little bit about your background and how you came to be doing what it is that you do?
The answer I usually give is that I lost a bet in a poker game, which is tends to be a little more interesting than the truth. After college, my wife and I decided to start a business. And this was back in 1984. And we were looking at either a dessert bar in Key West, Florida, or a carpet cleaning company in Austin. I had an opportunity that came up. I know, right? My bachelor's is in psychology, and I worked in a full-service psychiatric unit for 5 years.
Wow.
One of the guys that I worked with came to Austin to go in business with his brother, which didn't work out. And he knew we had talked over the years. And in high school, I worked for a mom and pop carpet cleaning shop. So I thought I knew everything there was about carpet cleaning. So we decided to come down. We tried. We never went in business with my friend. And after the first day, I realized I knew absolutely nothing about carpet cleaning. and at the time, there wasn't really a lot of resources available for carpet cleaning. I went to the libraries, everything was geared toward the dry cleaning industry, the apparel industry, more than it was for rugs. But stumbled around, I found a gentleman who helped me a lot. He had a janitorial supply company and really helped me get right in terms of what to do. And my wife and I have always wanted to be the best at whatever we do. So we were started out cleaning apartments for nothing, but we really cut our teeth on that and certainly learned a lot of things. We would shampoo carpets. And the first time I got a hold of a shampooer, which is like a floor buffing machine, people have probably seen them. The first time I turned it on, it threw me against the wall. It pinned me up. My feet were off the floor and it came unplugged.
I just
couldn't stop laughing. I mean, that was the most hilarious thing I'd ever experienced. But so anyway, after a time, we found a local association in the carpet cleaning industry. And I joined them. And even a longer story short, I became a board of director of a nonprofit called the IICRC, which was the Institute for Inspection, Cleaning, and Restoration Certification. I was with them for about 15 years, and it was a wonderful experience. I got to meet cleaners from all over the world. While there, I became the chairman of the Instructors in Schools Committee. What we did was establish criteria for schools to offer courses and approved instructors to teach those courses. We didn't own any schools. We didn't own any instructors. But my job was to vet them and also review the manuals. So I've got an incredible library, not the one behind me, but in another room, of all these manuals on everything from, you know, floor inspections, subfloor inspections, leather cleaning, upholstery cleaning, carpet, just everything. And I was with him for about 15 years, and I was actually became the vice president of that organization. And while there, I was fortunate enough to be able to chair the committee that developed the rug cleaning technician course. And that was very exciting because we literally had people from around the world putting input on this. And their courses tended to become ANSI approved. So there was just a ton of a peer review in terms of what we were putting out and what we were doing. That's kind of how I got really started. When I first started, shortly after I was pinned against the wall with that machine, I had a few residential clients. And the residential client, one of them in particular, they owned a produce company here in town. Well, this is one of the locations. But she would go on a buying trip to the Middle East once or twice a year. And she loved me and she wanted me to clean her oriental rugs. So she would ship them from wherever directly to me and I would clean them. I knew nothing about cleaning them, but she was very confident that I would figure it out. And so when we started out, I was cleaning oriental rugs on my driveway at our home and using a garden hose and a shampooer and a squeegee. And so from there, it started developing, and my passion for rugs really kicked in then. Another opportunity came up. A gentleman called me out of the blue and essentially offered me his carpet cleaning division. This was a company in town called Fashion Floors. And at that time, in the Yellow Pages, I had my picture in my ad. Nothing like I look now, much better, hair and everything. But he was going through the phone book and he saw my picture and he called me out of the blue. He said, "You don't know me, my name's Leroy, and I'd like to make you an offer." So we met. I never knew this guy. At that time, I didn't even know of Fashion Floors, which was a fairly large operation here. And he made me an offer I couldn't refuse, essentially sold me all the equipment for cleaning area rugs. They had gotten the equipment back in the probably early 80s when we had terrible floods here, like yes. Shoal Creek flooded over. And so they would go in and actually take wall-to-wall carpet out of homes, bring it back, put it through their rug cleaning equipment, dry it, then take it back out and reinstall it. But I realized what they had when I saw it and realized, no, this is really more for rugs. And they did do rugs. But when it started, it was by somebody who really knew rugs and how to clean rugs. And that person had retired and eventually passed away, but he was a wonderful guy. And this operation they had for cleaning rugs and was run by essentially kids who really didn't know what they were doing. So I took it over and, eventually went for more and more education. Currently, I'm certified as a certified rug specialist by the Association of Rug Care Specialists and also a master textile cleaner by the IICRC. So education's always been good. My people get tons of education when they start working for me. And we're not a large operation. There's seven of us, but everybody has been with me for years and years. I don't get a lot of turnover. I was big at one time and didn't like it. I couldn't sleep well. I didn't want to micromanage, but I was very concerned about how things were being done that I had no control over. So we downsized. We focused just on rugs. And the rest has kind of brought us to this point.
Well, it speaks so well of you that you've been able to both keep such solid employees and such a great reputation. I know that when I came to you, it was I was told, and I can't remember who sent me to you, that basically this is the only person in town to do repair on the type of rug I was talking about at the looking at the time, and it was an oriental rug. But it's interesting that people don't have any idea, and I want you to say a little more about this. All that you have to know as far as information about dyes and fibers and the history of rugs and the value as well, because you have to to have, I would think, a sense of how important, in quotes, and valuable the items are that you're actually handling. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, knowing the fiber content, knowing what it's made out of, knowing how it was dyed, knowing what country it's from, because there are some countries where it doesn't matter what you get, you know, the carpet's going to bleed. But that also helps in terms of pre-qualifying, and we explain tremendously about minutia or details probably people don't want to know, but we go ahead and we like to educate them and inform them. That's one of our, part of our mission statement is to educate and inspire. But yeah, so knowing the construction helps tremendously with the repair work. Essentially, the rug tells you everything. You just need to be able to read it. And in doing repairs, and we've, I have three people doing my repair work right now, and I could use probably five more. We are very backed up in repairs. And it started years ago. I went up, I got the opportunity to take a rug repair course in Washington, D.C., that was taught by a gentleman who was a consultant for the Textile Museum in Washington. Mm-hmm. He was an Iranian fellow, David Sapur. And he was very thorough in his team. We were there probably a couple, about a week, week and a half maybe. And he tore up everything I did. I was doing it wrong. I was doing this. I was doing that. And I'd had little books on how to repair rugs. And this was really before the internet came with YouTube and how to do everything. So this was still a research thing. But he was very good about it. He was very patient with me eventually and knew that I really wanted to learn. So after I got back, I trained two of my technicians. One was absolutely brilliant. She has since retired, but we still stay in contact. And then my son took to it. So he's doing it. His fiance took to it. And I actually put her in charge of the department over my son. But that's because she was just more, I think, geared to the big picture, mm-hmm. where my son tends to be focused on one thing kind of at a time, mm-hmm. which is still good. You kind of need people.
Those things have value, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you want somebody that's obsessive compulsive and anal retentive, and you want somebody who can who's artistic, and you can't just put an ad out for weavers. You have to actually train them. You have to find the people with the right temperament, the right mentality, and then you can train them on what to do.
So you bring up something that not everybody might know. Sorry to interrupt you. You bring up something that everybody might not know. You mentioned weavers. Why, Mike, would we need a weaver? I do know, but I'm our audience.
To be honest, we don't really need weavers. Weavers is kind of a byproduct. In fact, most of the world weavers that actually make rugs cannot repair them. They don't understand that part of taking a section out of the middle of the rug and putting it back in. It's kind of beyond there because they're always dealt, you know, they're always dealing on a loom and they're building a rug, you know, up from the bottom. And that's really what they know and that's what they focus on. They just can't grasp the concept of damaged rugs and how to fix them because that's not what they were taught. Finding somebody who has the mentality, you know, a lot of times you can find some ladies that go to trying to think of fiber shops, what they're called. They do like cross point and needle point and those kind of things. They can actually kind of meld into repair work in weavings. Finding somebody like that, that has the right, somebody who can use a needle and thread, that's paramount. And then you kind of train them. And sometimes you have to untrain what they may think and what they may do in terms of how to understand a rug and what it's telling you. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I send my people, there's a gentleman out in Denver, Colorado, Robert Mann. And he's real well known, actually, internationally. but I send them out to the rug repair courses that he offers, and they come back really energized and hyped, and we're always buying new yarns and new equipment or new tools. I just bought 52 skeins of wool from a friend I've made in Iran. So these are actually Persian yarns, which what you need for working on Persian rugs. And I bought us quite a few tools from them because I myself like to use the old tools, the old world tools, where my kids tend to like more, you know, crochet hooks and needles and thread. And I use Persian knife hooks and things like that that are just, I like old school stuff. That's just me. But so yeah, there's a lot to learn. There's a lot to be found out. Some people think, well, can you just, you know, close the end of the rug and it's done? And yeah, sometimes we can, but sometimes it's, you're actually doing harm to the rug. And our first rule tends to be do no harm. Whatever we do could be undone.
That's interesting. So we have a client that recently purchased a rug, I think out of Houston, and it didn't fit the room. So it was an Oriental, maybe, I don't know where it was from actually, but, and it didn't fit the room. And so the rug seller took off the outside, I guess the framing piece. What would you call that? Like
then? Could be the overcast or the fringe or the border.
And then reapplied, took the fringe, took out a section of the decoration of the rug, and then kind of redesigned reapplying that fringe area so that it looked finished, kept the other part of the rug so that one day that client could come back to him and reapply that missing piece. And that we're talking about a 20 by, you know, 15 foot rug. This is not a small endeavor. Right, so that's so interesting that it can even happen, and that the value of the rug is still there and can be that. You know, talk to us a little bit about that, like how you can trade rugs back in, purchase them, and then they hold their value and sell them again. And talk a little bit about that.
No, I'm not specifically in the retail side of the business, but most rug retailers will take rugs and trade. Or if you buy it from them, they will trade up whenever you're finished with the rug, bring it into them, and they'll get you a better rug or bigger rug or something. Or just another rug.
Do you have a moral problem with what I just described my client doing, taking out decorative pieces of the rugs? And
one of my really good friends, one of my really good friends is an appraiser in San Antonio. And interestingly enough, there's actually only two certified rug appraisers in Texas. This gentleman in San Antonio and a woman in Dallas. And I know them both very well. This guy, his feeling is whenever you modify a rug, you devalue it. So even keeping that piece, at some point, if it's put back on, could possibly even increase the value of the rug versus what it is now.
Oh, interesting.
So, and then again, also, there's four ways to correct damage in a rug. And the first is called conservation. Conservation is something most appreciated by collectors, museums, appraisers, and it doesn't pretty the rug up. It just keeps it from getting worse. So rugs that get worn out or rugs that have dogs chew them or whatever it might be, just securing that damage to keep it from getting worse and going more into the rug is conservation. It's the least expensive thing that can be done, but it's also the most desired for a lot of people. The second thing is called restoration, and restoration spares no expense. In restoration, rugs are most often sent to Turkey because they can get the same appropriately aged wool, the appropriately dyed wool, and appropriate materials used to reweave a rug. I just recently had a Navajo rug that came in, and the lady really wanted to restore it. It was in bad shape, but you could still see it's a rug. And contacted with Robert Mann out in Denver, who has a sister company in Turkey. He sent it to Turkey. I think it cost around $8,000 to have this rug restored. But when it came back, its monetary value was $20,000. So for investment pieces, going there is really good. This Iranian friend that I made that I've ordered 52 skeins of yarn from, I just saw he has like 50, 60, and 70-year-old yarn that he's also selling. So at some point, I'm going to buy that. But right now, my second shipment of that order is stuck in Tehran. And I don't know if it's because of things that are going on. I don't know if it's embargo, but he's trying to track it down and figure. I got the first batch, but the second batch got held up. And that's something we have to deal with in the rug world, to do restoration.
Conservation, restoration. What's our goal?
Repair. And that's what everybody tends to think of. Whatever you do to a rug, you're repairing it. And repair tends to use newer materials in older rugs. So, you know, from an appraisal standpoint, it's been repaired. It can be well repaired, but that also has an impact on the value of a rug. Restoration increases the value. Repair can stabilize it, can still have, you know, it can be done to where people can't see it. But any appraiser, somebody really knowledgeable, can usually look at the back of the rug or the top of the rug and know that repair work has been done. Now, on older pieces, there's no way repair work hasn't been done. If you get a rug from 1920 or 1880, chances are very good that in its life, it's had some work done, kind of like people. The older we get, the more work we tend to have done. But at any rate, yeah, so that's repair work. That's what we do here locally. And then the final thing is called concealment. And concealment is something nobody really likes. Nobody in the rug industry, I should say, let's see, nobody in the rug appraisal industry likes. It's something done by a lot of unscrupulous rug dealers. And I'm sure you've seen rugs that are threadbare, worn out. You can kind of see the foundation yarns. Some people go in and they use inks or dyes to touch up that exposed foundation yarn. It's not protecting it in any way, but it makes it less visible when you're looking at it. Also putting latex on the back to hold something in place or things like that. So concealment's the least desirable thing. I can't say that we don't do it. There are situations where, you know, a rug may really not have any value except sentimental, or except that they really like it and they can't find another one, but they don't want to go to the expense of repair or even conservation. And there are some things we will do, but not without really educating them first, telling them why we don't like to do it. Those are the four kind of ways to correct damage in a rug. And what most people do in the States is going to be repair, some restoration in some houses. Robert Mann has some restoration he can do, but a lot of it, like I said, is sent to Turkey. And it's probably interesting to think that we sent a Navajo rug to Turkey to get fixed, but they have the exact yarns, or they make them and out of Kuro sheep or whatever, you know, whatever the wool is that's being used. And recently, Robert and one of his friends, Teddy Vardell, have created a line of rug wools specifically for Navajos, specifically for Turkish, specifically for Persian, you know. So you get a lot of these really specialized yarns, which definitely increases, because we like to make it as good as new as we possibly can. So getting the right materials is paramount to doing that.
So for me, you've done concealment on a rug of mine that didn't have the value, that was threadbare. And then you've done rug cleaning. So I have two things I wanted to circle back to. I'll say the first one, this one first, because I think it's less interesting. but to me and to maybe to the audience, that the fashion moment that happens with rugs, you know, as an interior designer, where I do see a lot of over dye on rugs that were very threadbare, and they're trying to remarket them. And there was a lot of, when I saw that happening, I was getting some education here and there as I was sort of ABC Carpet and Home and shopping and in New York, and then a little bit of information, just enough information to get myself in trouble and open my mouth and say the wrong thing. But I had a very strong opinion that a lot of those colors, they were very fuchsia, bright, and very harsh. I thought, and I might have even said this to you when we've met and talked, that they were, that was part of the devaluing of it, was the actually quality of the color. But I have come to find that actually that's not so much the case, that some of those colors are historic in nature, but mm-hmm. the way they're being applied and the rugs they're being applied to, am I right here, is where the issues are?
Yeah, you're definitely right. And, you know, it can be old, worn out rugs that are getting re-dyed, over-dyed. But actually, there's a lot of overdyed rugs that come out that really are worn out. They just wouldn't sell.
Yes.
The colors aren't right. Colors. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what they'll do is sometimes they wash them out. Sometimes they just overdye them. But the problem we find is it depends on who's doing the dyeing, how stable that dye is, because we'll get an overdyed rug. We'll test and we'll know it's just going to wash out as soon as we put water on it. And there are some, and like what we do when we overdye, it's permanent. It's not going to fade out or sun or a washout in the next washing. But not everybody does it that way. And especially in the rug market and the rug game, you just don't know what's been done to rugs to, you know, they'll throw them out in the street, let traffic drive over them, let animals walk over them, just so they can antique them, kind of, for the American and European market that tend to like older rugs. So there's a lot of them. They'll over dye them with tea wash to give them that softer patina to make them look that way. So yeah, there's a lot of things that are done. They typically don't add value to the rug other than and the value of the rug is what you can sell it for. So when overdyed rugs become popular, yeah, they can sell for, you know, a fairly good amount. Currently, I'm sure you're aware of this, the trend tends to be for non-traditional rugs, more the modern, you know, fibers of the modern sort of watercolor painting, abstract looking rugs compared to the traditional designs and things like that. So if you have these old rugs that are traditional, they may not be worth what you bought them for. But like in anything, the pendulum swings in the rug world. So what's not popular now, and I personally feel probably in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a resurgence and a comeback of traditional rugs, things like that. I think some people are unhappy with performance of some of the newer fibers that they're making in rugs. They're paying a lot for them, but yeah, so the rug game is a very interesting market. And as I said, you know, if I get a rug from Morocco, I pretty much can guarantee it's going to bleed. And there is a new Atlas Mountain project going on that is really teaching weavers in Morocco. Some new stuff coming out of Morocco is actually really nice and color stable, things like that. But for years they didn't. You know, resources are limited. After they dye a rug, they don't always have the ability to have enough water to rinse it. So a lot of those dyes that are in there become fugitive once they get wet and they can run. So you have, you know, dye crocking, which is excess dye in a fiber, or dye bleeding, which is the migration of one color into another color, the lighter colors typically. Reds into whites, they become pink, you know, that kind of thing. But for Morocco, for years, they just, there's, when you're making a dye bath, and often they're using natural materials. They'll use plant materials, synthetic dyes, they'll use insects, they'll use seashells, things that will give different colors. But in giving the color, the most important thing that they should add is a metal, and it's termed a mordant. And mordants will actually make a wool dye, a color strike onto a wool dye and stay. Without them, you know, wool is inherently very stain resistant.
Yes.
It can be easy to
like
dye.
It.
Yeah. Very stain resistant, very soil resistant. But it's what makes it, it could be very subject to staining by things that are hot, like coffee or teas that are hot can really do some permanent damage to a rug. But they don't, they're not using things that are really stabilizing colors. So when I get one in, it's like, oh yeah, well, I can tell you right now, we have an issue. The other thing that they do in particular is after they make a rug, because it's so color unstable, they'll often go over it with bleach, literally Clorox bleach, and bleach it out. So when you see these faded rugs from Morocco, you flip it over and it's incredibly colorful on the back. Well, these rugs have been bleached. Yeah. And if they're washed, a lot of those colors can come back up. Mm-hmm. And for years, we had an issue with that. What we finally found out, in most cases, was that you dry it in the sun and that would reactivate the bleach. So it would, it would actually kind of fade them back out again to what it was originally.
So the other project you did for me was a cleaning project. And I think there was a little bit of migrating, you mentioned
color
just
migrating.
Now with the color migrating. And before you cleaned it, you told me that might happen with the red. And it did end up happening. What's also true is when my cats pee on it in that spot, migrates further. So that's migrating all the way into the marble underneath the floor, the marble tile. So maybe you could come clean my marbles anyway. But I have a question. One thing that I have heard, I don't know if it's true, is talk to us a little bit about the value of not washing a rug. Like, is there ever a time where you mentioned the aged wools and things? Is there ever a time where, or like antiquing, where the dirt and the frankly the filth that might be embedded in those fibers is better to just conserve and leave alone versus try to get out? I don't know if that's true at all. It was a question that popped into my mind.
Yeah. As I mentioned, I was with that group, that nonprofit group, and we did the rug cleaning technician course. So we had people from all around the world giving input on these kind of things. And the general, and my job as chairman was to herd the cats, because the egos were huge all around the world, and it was an ordeal to deal with. But the consensus was that if you clean a rug properly every 2 to 3 years, it will extend its useful life.
Ah.
Now, old rugs that we get that are threadbare, where the nap is worn off, is strictly a result of dry particulate soil that gets down in there. The first thing we do when cleaning any rug is we dust it. We have a couple of 4 or 5 ways of dusting, but the best way we have is called a tumble duster. We put the rug in and it's sort of like a big bingo cage. It's 10 feet wide, 5 feet in diameter, and it's in an enclosed room. And it turns the rug and it kind of goes up and drops down, goes up, drops down, really shaking loose all of that soil. And as opposed to doing it in a flat plane, we're actually able to manipulate the fibers to get more out. It's one of the older methods. If you went on YouTube or something like that, or TikTok, you could find some old vintage footage of how they used to tumble dust rugs overseas. And it's pretty much the same thing, just revitalized. But some rugs are too old to go through that. And we have other ways. Sometimes it's simple as compressed air to kind of blow it out. We also have a, what's called a flatbed duster, which does, it's sort of equivalent of when they used to hang them on lines and beat them with rug beaters. So it's kind of in a horizontal plane, but there are straps that slap the back of the carpet as it's fed over a vacuum chamber. Some rugs that are older, we can tolerate that. Years ago, I mean, everybody took their rugs outside and beat them, but nobody has the ability to do that anymore. So that's the first thing, getting rid of the dry soil, because that is what will shorten the life of a rug drastically. Mm-hmm. You know, hand-knotted rugs, hand-knotted wool rugs have a useful life of, 50 to 300 years. It can be that dramatic if it's well taken care of. And there are examples of rugs around the world that are, that old and still in remarkable condition. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's getting rid of the dry stuff is paramount. Not doing anything is just really kind of decreasing the useful life of the rug.
Okay, I guess I better bring my rug back in.
I was just going to ask, I love Pillum rugs. And so mm-hmm. what's the best way to treat those? Is it to kind of go out and beat them and get all the dry dust off? Or
Killums and Duries and Navajos and all flat woven rugs that tend to be reversible mm-hmm. don't have the pile that can be damaged as much.
Oh, okay.
So it's still good to always dust them because, dry particulate soil, unfortunately, is not smooth spherical shapes. It's burrs and shards and jagged edges, and it'll get into that wool that's on the killum and mm-hmm. can make killums threadbare also. Now, a lot of killums, the Turkish ones, were on wool foundations originally. So that could just keep digging in there. Most all flat weaves, always exceptions to every rule, but most all flat weaves we use today or see today are on a cotton foundation, with a wool wrapping. It's called weft wrapping when they do that. Killums, it's called slit weave construction because when you hold your killum up to the light, you can see the slits between all the colors where they join. Like on a Duri or a Navajo, you won't see that if you hold it up to the light. So there's an overlap on Duris and Navajos or other flat weaves. Wherever they join color, there's actually kind of a lump there from going to one color to the other color and kind of marrying them together. In a slit weave, you don't have that. So you have some potential for it being weaker because of that too. But yeah, killums are... go ahead.
Sorry, you mentioned cotton. I had a braided rug. I love braided rugs. Braided wool rug that the moths got to. Long story, but essentially the Lego boxes under my son's bed hid a myriad of issues and the moths got to it before it was discovered. Then we had been taking care of the part of the rug we could see, but we hadn't been doing a good enough job under there. And boy, they did a number. You could see that there was cotton, I guess that's weft, in there. I had no idea.
Sometimes works. Yeah, they won't touch that. They're not interested.
Didn't think cotton. They didn't think that was yummy at all. They just ate all around. It's a perfectly clean cotton band running through there. And it was educational for me. That rug was made.
But, sure.
Yeah.
And it's the serotonin in the wool. And it also happens in silk rugs that's what they really want to eat. So, mm-hmm. I had one years ago. This elderly lady, she was so funny. She was a wonderful lady. But we pulled the bed out under her rug, which had been there probably at least 60 years. And she had a skirt down on the bed. So when we pulled it out, there was nothing left under the bed except the cotton foundation. So it looked like graph paper, you know what I mean? And she was so funny about that too. But anyway, it was too much at her age to really invest in trying to reweave this rug. It would have been cost prohibitive. But that rug could have been made into other rugs, like you'd mentioned earlier about resizing rugs and things like that. But yeah, the moths, and for whatever reason, I've seen more moth infestation and damage in the last probably 9 years than I've seen in the last 40 years. And it's not just here. It's all around the country. I mean, it's all over. And I think there's several reasons for that. But the two top ones, I think that we're getting, the EPA got involved with pest control companies. So things that we used to use that were very effective are no longer allowed. So I think that really cut down. We use botanicals when we're dealing with moths. So we don't need a pest control license for it, but it's actually things that have been used forever in the rug industry, but not so much in the other industries. And I lost my train of thought. I was going somewhere with that.
You were talking about the moths and the reasons you said first, the EPA being involved, and maybe there was another reason you were about to go into.
A lot of people can now buy rugs directly from other countries. So I think because I've seen how they store rugs in other countries, and moth infestation is not unknown and more probably more the rule than the exception in a lot of cases, but a lot of these will come into the country containing eggs that conditions are ripe, they'll, you know, under a bed, under a sofa, where it's never vacuumed or it's never really looked at. That's the ideal place for moths. Yeah. And it's not the flying moths don't eat anything. They don't eat wool. They don't eat anything at all. They don't drink water. They don't do anything. All they do for the 2 weeks or 3 weeks of their life is reproduce and lay eggs. That's it. In fact, the bats under the Austin Bridge, they fly out. They go out to the farmers' fields out east. That's the primary food source for them are these moths that lay eggs in wool. So they're wonderful. Having bats around are great. But the life cycle of a moth is interesting in the sense that, you know, the only time that they eat is when they're in the larva stage, the pupa stage. Mm-hmm. And that's when you'll see the little white worms or the little white maggot looking things. And then they'll build their own cocoons, just like butterflies. And when they're finished with that and they hibernate and the times are right, they hatch into a moth and go off and mate and lay eggs. That's kind of
unfortunately, I saw that entire process play out in my son's bedroom. Every single one of those things you described. It was horrifying to find that. We're clean people, but it was easy to hide under the Lego boxes.
Exactly. And it's fascinating how they get in there. Under, because we'll have moth damage under a heavy pedestal table. Underneath it, it's completely eaten. So they're not flying to it. They have to be crawling to it. Or when they lay the eggs around it, the eggs have some sense that, you know, they know that's an out-of-the-way place. And they head that direction. But yeah, we get a lot of moth damage.
We're getting ready to sort of wrap up our conversation today, but I wanted to, before we do that, I want to, first of all, thank you so much and give you another moment to kind of promote yourself. And then if there's anything we haven't asked you that you want to say, please take a minute to do so.
There's a lot of interesting things in rugs, not to everybody. Historically, you know, the oldest known rug is called the Pazirak rug, and it was found in a tomb of a chieftain in Russia, in Pazirak Valley. It's 2,500 years old. The reason it was so well preserved is because after the guy was buried, looters came in, and they left it open. Well, ice and freezing conditions came in. The chieftain himself was incredibly preserved. You could still see all the tattoos on his body. The rug was literally in a sheet of ice. And it's interesting. It's in the Hermitage Museum in Georgia, Russia, course, but it occasionally goes on tour, and it's really fascinating to see. So yeah, I like that about the historical significance. Interestingly enough, he also had cannabis seeds in his tomb with an inhalation tent that he would put over his head.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. But as far as us, you know, we
and a rug.
And the rug and a chariot and you know, all sorts of these other things that the looters didn't take.
Comfort
things. But as far as Austonian rugs, I mean, we're not a large operation. We hopefully have a nice reputation. We've got great reviews and everywhere, and we really like to do things one at a time, and we like to do things the way they should be done. And not everybody does that. Some companies are based more on quantity, you know, get it in, get it washed, get it out, get it to the next one, you know. And we've never been that way. I think my wife and I, from our early roots on shampooing, you know, apartments, and we always wanted to be the best at whatever we were at doing. And that hasn't changed a bit. And we love to educate people on their rugs, let them know maybe some of the historical significance of their rugs. At some point, we can talk about American Sarooks, which really started the revitalization of rug making in the Middle East. There's a lot of little things like that that are always interesting. And we're here
we'll
for everybody.
We'll have to have you back for another one of our podcasts.
I'd be more than happy to. Yeah.
Thank you, Mike. We really appreciate you being here. And we also know at Amity World and Company, at least, never to rush you. Unless we get something from you. I don't mean that you're slow. I just mean that you're careful. And we hats off to you and what you do.
That's kind words. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Design Oracles with Amity World, owner of Amity World and Company, and Diane Kett, owner of DK Studio.